Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we are chatting with Daniel Gruss, an InfoSec researcher who's doing a postdoc in the Secure Systems Group at the Graz University of Technology in Austria. Daniel was one of the authors of a recent paper on a new Rowhammer technique. This one's pretty clever, basically because it evades all known detection techniques by executing in an Intel SGX enclave. These enclaves are pretty restricted. You can't run some instructions, you can't do syscalls, that sort of stuff, but you can hammer RAM for privilege escalation, and currently there is not much we can do in software to make this, these new type of Rowhammer attacks go away. That is this week's feature, and it is coming up after the news. In this week's sponsor interview, we chat with Dan Guido from Trail of Bits. Trail of Bits is a consultancy in the United States, and I guess what makes them interesting is they're a bit different, I guess, to a typical pen test firm. They're more like a security engineering firm. Instead of dumping a report on you and telling you what's wrong, they actually come in, they find the problems, and then they fix them. They will commit code to fix problems, and they even build and customize tools for their clients. So when Dan heard a recent episode of this podcast where I spoke with Natalie Silvanovich and Harun Mir about developing secure software projects and empowering security engineers in organizations to actually build stuff, Dan's ears pricked up because that's what they do, right? Like, they enable these sorts of projects. So he's along this week to talk about his experience in helping to build secure software and security tools for his clients, what approaches work, how to make those projects successful by aiming for incremental improvements instead of going for a four-year, waterfall thing with a win at the end of it. That is all very interesting stuff, and it is coming up in this week's sponsor interview. But before we get into all of that, it is time, of course, for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, we have to kick off this week's news segment with the news of the so-called crack attacks. It's the Wi-Fi Mageddon of 2017. Or is it? Seems like this could be a little overhyped.
Yeah, so there's definitely arguments on both sides of that fence. I mean, I think it has certainly been overhyped, and the mainstream media in particular has done an awful job of
like really bad
bug.
Really
like
bad.
In New Zealand,
every single
seen,
Wi-Fi hacked, like that sort of
like
stuff.
In,
it's proper
in
bad.
New Zealand, we saw like push notifications to people's phones saying all New Zealanders should stop using Wi-Fi. Like yeah. It was just ridiculous, completely and utterly ridiculous. That said, it's a sweet bug, or rather, I guess, a collection of bugs and basically the same sort of thing in the crypto of the WPA2 key exchange, or WPA and WPA2 key exchange mechanism. If you haven't read about it, essentially the deal is that you can force reuse of a cryptographic nonce during the key exchange by replaying a particular part of the message and kind of basically inserting yourself in between the real access point and a client, or between a client and its access point, and then depending on the combination of where you replayed your thing, like during which particular cryptographic exchange and what sort of cipher is being used, you can do different things. And in the worst case, in combination with another bug in the Linux WPA supplicant wireless client, which is also used in Android, you can actually get full-on bidirectional decryption of traffic between the client and the access point, which for some people would actually be a pretty serious impact. Although, the idea that people can hack your internet comms, I guess, is why we have TLS and why people have been pushing for DNSSEC and all these kind of things, because the underlying communications medium should be untrusted. And, obviously breaking the wireless leg is,
I mean, we're always talking about deperimeterization and, Google's BeyondCorp initiative and, Duo's vision of that as well. And it's all about zero trust networks, right?
And indeed, you should not trust the network. And this is a really good example of why.
Your LAN is the internet. People,
Well, exactly, right? Exactly. That said, we haven't seen a bug like this in WPA. I mean, the last big round, the only bug useful bug we've ever seen in WPA was related to the pin-based automatic keying, the WPS standard thing, which was a dumb idea in the first place, and very few people did. In terms of enterprise WPA, this really is the first bug we've seen. I mean, there hasn't been anything like this since WEP. Predating the 802.11i standard. So for a lot of people, this is a really scary bug because it's an area of the networking environment that we've been able to rely on by and large.
Maybe we've been able to rely on it a little bit too much, though. I've always felt that people got a little bit too comfortable with WPA, right? And they were like, oh, yeah, we'll just allow, you know, the same access as wired. So, you know, there's that angle to it as well. Now, you sent me a demo video of this, which is pretty sobering, which shows this bug being used against like an Android, an Android 6 device. And it's pretty cool. They get SSL strip running on it and all of that. Now, given that this is like a pretty involved man in the middle, not just observing a stream, like it's actually proxying stuff and changing stuff, does that mean that you can then, you know, use this bug to essentially piggyback on that device's association with the network and do stuff like start scanning internal resources?
So no, and no with some caveats. So there's a selection of bugs. Like there is the bug that allows you to decrypt some packets, forge some packets in some cases, and then whether or not you can and replay some packets, which is not so useful in this case, and the detail about when you can forge and when you can decrypt and in which direction, like from the access point to the client, from the client to the access point, depends on some things, which particular negotiation you're getting in the middle of, and which cipher mode. This Android thing with the null key is actually kind of a separate issue. And in the demo video, it's not super clear, because we haven't seen the demo code yet, but in the demo video, the guy, Matthew, whose bug this is, man in the middle is the connection from an Android device to the access point. Then he decrypts, and this is my reading of it, like I may be missing something because obviously we haven't seen the code yet, but my reading of it is he decrypts the connection going past, observes the TCP sequence numbers of the connection that's in progress outbound towards a site that doesn't have HTTPS so that he can later on SSL strip it, and then pulls that connection out and sends it off across his own internet connection. But because he knows sequence numbers, he can get in the middle of it, even though he didn't necessarily see the beginning of it, and then he SSL strips that. So it's not going over the existing access point. It's going across a third-party internet connection provided by the attacker. So that doesn't imply that you can then go onwards into the rest of the real network. Now, there are some situations where you might be able to with the wireless networks that use the GCMP cipher rather than the more common ones. That's not a super common configuration. It may also be possible in the case of TKIP, which is a much more common configuration, if you do it in both directions at once. But these are kind of specific details that we really haven't, like whether or not you can do the same attack in both directions in the two different ways on a TKIP network and get bidirectional connectivity onwards to the rest of the network isn't actually that clear yet.
Now, this is why I'm saying that this is overhyped, right? Because what they're saying is if you've got physical proximity to a to an old device, usually like Android 6 or whatever, using Wi-Fi, that you can, you know, inject some packets and whatever. Now, I'd suggest that an easier way to do that is wait for that thing to start scanning for an SSID, you know, an unencrypted SSID, and you just use a, you know, rogue access point association trick to get it to connect. Okay? So this doesn't get you really anything more as an attacker, unless we're talking about the case, as you pointed out, it's kind of rare, the GCMP case, in which case you can associate with that network, and that is very, very bad. But the rest of the sort of scenarios in this, you know, I mean, I don't really see them as being a massive, massive big deal.
I think the one case where, well, the one that sticks out to me is the enterprise wireless network example. So, I mean, you're right. For most people who've got a rubbish Android phone, it's going to be easier to use, you know, Karma or whatever rogue AP tricks to get them to connect to an already open network that you're running and just you've got full access to them. Everything's fine. You don't have to do anything else. And I don't think this attack buys you much in that scenario. But in the enterprise scenario where the wireless configuration is locked down by group policy, the users don't get to add unsecured wireless networks to it, and that wireless network is corporate LAN, you know, wired network equivalent access, and now you can decrypt traffic, which, I mean, is not unusual even in the case of Android phones. Like Windows devices are not particularly affected by this because of its not entirely standards compliant implementation, apparently. But I mean, Android devices on a corporate, like a MDM-managed Android devices on a corporate network that otherwise would not connect to you, I think this would actually be
But what does it get you, Adam? What does it actually get you? Because what I'm thinking is, I mean, most, you know, there's going to be another layer of encryption on most of the stuff that you're pulling this way anyway. I'm just wondering what this actually gets you.
The scenario specifically that I'm thinking of is Android, so MDM managed Android device, which uses WPA, EAP, PEEP with domain username integrated authentication. So the Android device logs into the corporate network using an AD domain credentials, username and password. Then we let it auth. Well, during the auth process, we hijack it. We decrypt subsequent messages from that network, from that machine out onto the network. And then we get like a net NTLM password auth going past.
And then you throw it at some rainbow internet. Tables we, and happy days.
We crack, well, I mean, we crack it. You know, rainbow tables are slower than cracking it these days with GPUs, but crack it by whatever mechanism. And then we auth back onto the network with those credentials. Like that's the scenario that I can see that we, you know, as people who break into people running enterprise networks, that's a scenario that I could see us using. There might be some niggles.
Well, the good news is if you're running MDM, right, which is when this becomes an issue, it shouldn't be too hard to kick ban Android 6 from your network.
Well, exactly. And although it is worth pointing out that subsequent to the publication of the paper, it has transpired that later versions of WPA Supplic and therefore later versions of Android are in fact vulnerable to the zero key variant of the attack, which does mean probably versions of Android phones beyond 6 are vulnerable also.
Okay. So I can see how that is absolutely going to be useful. Yeah, 100% agree that that's absolutely going to be useful. But still, I feel that this is somewhat overhyped.
Yeah, no, I agree. It is absolutely overhyped. There will be very specific cases where this is a super useful, very practical, real-world attack that we will use, but it is not a thing that people need to be running and screaming in the streets about.
Yeah, I mean, you really, an attacker, where it's going to be most useful for an attacker, excluding the case of GCMP when it's like straight up network association, and that's, you know, that's horrible. But outside of that scenario, it looks like basically as an attacker, you need a vulnerable device, a device vulnerable to this bug, to start sending around crackable authentication packets around, and then you can grab them, right? So, I mean, that's the scenario that you've described. And I'm thinking beyond some phones and, you know, MDM management, I mean, everyone's sort of harping on about IoT devices and stuff. And I'm thinking, great, you know, you got my, you captured some packets from my smart thermostat, you know, big deal. Because it seems like, you know, most of the devices that are going to be handling important information, they're going to be the ones that get patched.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, the overall impact of this is not going to be that huge. It's going to scare a lot of people, which actually may be useful. I mean, and especially in corporate and enterprise environments where, as you said, people have relied on this a little too much. And I think, them, you know, having them be scared by it is probably a useful thing. But in terms of real attacks, I mean, I'm not sure that it's going to be super big. Although, actually, that said, the TKIP variants of these, if I'm reading the paper right, do look like they could actually be quite useful. And TKIP is significantly more widely deployed than GCMP. And that would be, I guess, one of the recommendations that people can do, regardless of a vendor patch, is to make sure that your wireless network is running a CCMP instead of TKIP for the Cypher suite. And that would at least limit the effectiveness of the kind of the worst bits of these attacks, as well as obviously patching everything as you can.
Well, that sounds like useful advice. But look, that's not the only crypto news this week. Oh man, this is pretty bad, right?
This is super bad.
Yeah, no, this is really bad because it was funny because I was, you know, as I was saying, like, you know, zero trust networks, and I was sort of posting on Twitter saying, hey, you know, this is why Google's into this BeyondCorp idea, deperimeterization, you know, it's all fantastic. And then some smart ass replied saying, well, then you'd be worried about the other crypto bug of this week, which affects things like, you know, like second factor crypto cards and stuff. Walk us through this one. This is bad.
Oh God. Yeah. So yeah, it's been a really great week on the crypto front. So Infineon Technology are a company that makes a bunch of microprocessors and other embedded systems. One of the things they manufacture is crypto chips for embedded, you know, cryptographic things such as smart cards, you know, authenticators, key storage, TPMs on computers, that kind of thing. Anyway, it turns out they're actually kind of bad at life and they implemented sometime many years ago, something like 2012, they implemented what sounds like a bad random number generator on one of their embedded RSA crypto microprocessors. And then, of course, they shipped this to all sorts of people. It's been used in all sorts of things. And now it turns out that the keys that those chips were generating are, you know, from the point of view of crypto, trivially factorable, given the public key. So you can look at the public key, and you can generate the private key through offline crypto, offline compute.
This properly breaks smart card off, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and we've seen, I think one of the worst implications of this has been the national smart card system in Estonia uses these cards. And this is Estonia that we've talked about in the past as being a sort of a, you know, a paragon of virtue by having a national PKI infrastructure that uses smart cards. Yeah, it turns out they've issued, you know, 750,000 smart cards that generate bad public key, bad key material. So yeah, that's pretty bad. And then, of course, there's the impact on TPM chips. We've seen these chips used in a number of manufacturers' computer systems, and where you've got disk crypto, like Microsoft BitLocker, for example, storing and using keys from the TPM, like that's actually a genuinely, you know, bad outcome.
Yeah, well, I mean, if your TPM RNG is broken, that's not a good thing.
You're going to have a very bad time.
I mean, I can imagine there's a few hard drives like in, you know, evidence lockers all around the world that are going to get dusted off in light of this to see if there's, you know, if they've narrowed down the key space enough for this to be, for them to be able to unlock that stuff.
Well, exactly. I imagine that is happening. Yeah, I mean, that's a, you know, very real-world impact of this. In terms of the amount of compute involved, it is worth noting that for 2048-bit RSA keys, we're talking something like $40,000 worth of Amazon compute time to crack one. So on average, half that, and some may fall out, you know, faster than that. For 1024-bit RSA, it's just minutes or something stupid like that. So, I mean, it's not a trivial attack, but from the point of view of attacking cryptography, and I guess it is. The other big impact from this, the other big loser in this, has been YubiKey and other like USB smart card style authentic second factor authentication tokens. Google, in particular, of course, have been pushing, as you said, with BeyondCorp pushing that kind of second factor as an important thing. Yeah, so it turns out a number of the YubiKeys, I think YubiKey 4s in particular, have this particular chip in it and are vulnerable. YubiKey is offering a replacement program, I believe. You can enter like the serial number of your YubiKeys in their relevant support page, and it will tell you if it's vulnerable, and if so, they'll give you a free replacement, I gather, which is really nice of them.
Yeah, I think that's about the best way you can handle this from a PR point of view.
Yeah, well, exactly, right? I mean, the real loser here is Infineon, who look like complete Muppets, and, you know, you'd like to hope that everyone else's implementations are better than that, but it just goes to show that these kinds of embedded systems that don't get enough visibility because they're, you know, treated as a proprietary black box, even when the standards are open, the implementation isn't. This is what we get, you know, that it's been fielded for years and years and years, and now we find out that it's complete rubbish, which is just not, you know, it's not good enough.
Well, turning our attention to other matters, there's a bill back before Congress in the United States that deals with, you know, so-called hacking back. And, you know, I'm not really sure how I feel about this because I know that there are, you know, I know people who, you know, own attackers, right, as part of their normal workflow. And they don't mind the status quo because they're very careful. They're not going to get caught doing it, which sort of naturally stops people from doing stuff that's really dumb. Like, unless you're very good at this, you shouldn't do it. And it being illegal stops people who aren't very good from doing it. So I just worry that if we make this legal, all of a sudden it's just going to be open season on any single box that looks like a C2 box, you know, on the planet. What do you think about this?
Yeah, and I agree completely with you. I think it's a terrible idea because, as you say, despite the fact that it's a super good way of doing attribution, you really don't want it to be a thing that's in large-scale use. I mean, even if for no other reason than, you know, it will disrupt real investigations run by real actual grown-ups, you know, rather than people who are just horsing around. And it just, yeah, it seems like a terrible thing to try and write sensible legislation that would legalize. And then the outcome is also going to be terrible. And I think you're right. The status quo where we just do it quietly under the covers and we don't really talk about it. And everyone who does it is smart enough to not get snapped doing it is kind of okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's what we would say, right? As the you know, we're becoming the old farts here, Adam. Right? So we would say that.
We need to let bug bounty kids hack back at attackers. That's a great idea.
Oh,
we should start.
Damn.
Venture capital for bug bounty kids to go hack people back. I think we're going to get so rich, man.
It's like Uber for disasters. moving on to the New York Times actually wrote a killer feature about North Korean quote-unquote cyber power. And I've got to coin a term for the North Koreans and how they do stuff now. I'm calling them internet Vikings because it's pretty much what they do, man. They're going out there, they're raiding, you know, central banks. There was another SWIFT attack attributed to North Korea quite recently too. We didn't actually have time for it in the show, but I think
which
that was just
ridiculous in itself. The fact that a nation state's hacking a bank and it's not even make it into our newsreel,
exactly, right? So that was a couple of weeks ago. But this story really looks at North Korea's you know, various programs, and a lot of it is just about stealing money, writing malware, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a great piece. It's absolutely worth reading, both from a, you know, hacking angle and a geopolitics angle. One of the things that really stood out to me in this story is the assertion that North Korea might be bringing in as much as a third of its foreign currency income from hacking. Like the number was $1 billion, I think, which, I mean, even if it's a quarter of that, and we've, you know, when we see them try to steal what, you know, $1 billion in one go from one SWIFT account, right? It's entirely plausible that they could be pulling in money like that. Like, that's quite a significant, I mean, you can see how important this must be for them, you know, in terms of being able to express their will overseas, as well as make real, you know, real money. I mean, you know, imagine having a weapon system that not only do you have to not pay for it, like it pays for itself and makes you money. Like, what? Why wouldn't you? So yeah, that's a great write up of, you know, the range of things they've been doing. There's a few tidbits that we hadn't seen before in terms of them hacking. There's a story about them hacking a TV network in the UK to prevent broadcast of a TV show that was criticizing Kim Jong-un, you know, after we saw them taking out Sony Pictures. So yeah, no, it's a really good write-up, totally worth reading.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the North Koreans have run all sorts of shady money-making schemes in the past, including running heroin on state-owned fishing boats into Australia in the 90s. I mean, this is the way that they roll, right? I mean, they will make money any way they can. But yes, what do you think? Cyber Vikings? Let's call them Cyber Vikings, because it's cringeworthy, but it kind of fits.
That's anyway. Bad. Except the Vikings have better hats than the Koreans do, so I don't know.
You don't know what they wear in the office. They could be wearing awesome hats, you know? Oh, now here's an interesting one. Reuters, Joseph Men with a bit of a scoop here. Apparently Microsoft's internal database, internal bug tracker that dealt with bugs in Microsoft products, it got owned by a very sort of sophisticated group about 4 years ago, and they kept it quiet. And five former employees have come forward. So hell of a scoop.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting story. Yeah, and I hadn't heard any gossip about them having the MSRC's bug tracker owned, because clearly that's the sort of thing that as an attacker is super useful, knowing where to find all of the soon-to-be-patched bugs that you can exploit in a hurry and don't have to worry about being too careful about.
Oh, these sort of attacks are as old as the internet. You know what I mean? Like, that's what you do with O-Day, is you use it to get more O-Day.
But no, apparently it was the same crew, I think it was at the time it was called Wild Neutron, that owned a bunch of Silicon Valley firms back in 2013, Apple, Facebook, Twitter were amongst the people that were using Java Zero Day. And, you know, you remember back in those days when Java was cool, Java Zero Day was the sweet thing to use. Anyway, yeah, they owned apparently Microsoft as well. And yeah, like, you can see the value of this data. It's amazing that Microsoft managed to keep that one quiet, given...
You know, if that was a live event, it's one thing when something's reported as just having happened. It's another thing where it was like, oh, here's a thing that happened 4 years ago. So they actually did manage to dodge the PR bullet with that. But I, you know, my personal belief is they should have been more transparent. Equifax, meanwhile, having a bit more trouble. I think this is like late last week. There was, you know, it was their website was trying to drop like fake Flash Player installs on visitors, which is super embarrassing. And it turns out the way that attackers were able to do this is because Equifax, the website, was still loading content from all these like orphaned domains, and someone just registered it and, you know, put some malware on it. So well done, Equifax. Adam, Google has launched this fantastic initiative. This is my favorite news item of the week. They've basically introduced a setting on their accounts for high security for people like journalists, people who work in politics, things like that. It means you'll enroll with a UTF key, like a YubiKey. They have a more restrictive account recovery procedure, and it will not allow other like third-party applications to get into your account via OAuth unless it's a Google application. This is such a great idea.
Yeah, no, it really is. And it's great to see this kind of push forward, because, I mean, so many people have been hacked by Google password reset. I mean, the John Podesta from the US getting owned. It's like, it's a thing we've seen used against high profile people. And this is a great response by Google. And obviously they've been working on this for some time, making sure it does actually, you know, still work as a, you know, the usability is still there. But yeah, this is definitely a very good move forward. And of course, the fact they're making this available to anyone who wants it lets people kind of figure out, you know, what their personal level of trade-off between functionality and security is. And it's great. Like, this is, yeah, as you say, a really good news story, which is, you know, there's not many of those lately, is there?
No, no. So check out Google Advanced Protection, and that's just for the consumer-grade accounts. You know, well done. You know, we've often spoken on the show about the need for tighter, you know, tighter password reset and account recovery procedures, and also the need for OAuth whitelisting, and that's exactly what they've done, and just bravo. Really, really fantastic stuff. Russia, meanwhile, has fined Telegram $14,000 for not giving the FSB access to user data because they're saying, hey, we're E2E, we can't do that. $14,000 fine, doubt it's going to get paid, but this is a sign of things to come in the future. I can guarantee that. And, you know, not just Russia.
Yeah, like this is not going to be the last time we see exactly this story go down. Obviously, the number is kind of little and clearly not big enough to really make any difference. But yeah, it demonstrates a willingness to go and, you know, use your national legal hammer to go beat some vendors up.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think Telegram is meaningfully based in Russia, right? So I don't know how much of an impact. I mean, even if they fined them $1 billion, I don't think it would have any impact.
No, but I guess it does send a message to anyone else who does have serious operations they're not willing to walk away from in Russia that, you know, this is a thing that's going to happen.
Oh, an interesting story from Australia here via the Sydney Morning Herald. The government here is considering introducing a star rating system for the security of IoT devices, things like baby monitors and, you know, whatever, right? It's going to be like an actual star rating system. And I just kind of think, well, that's a pretty good idea. That the government here seems to have been making all the right moves, to be honest, in security lately. I'm not used to it. It's really weird. What do you think of this, though?
I think it's a good idea. It's one of those things where, you know, the problem with security is that it's entirely opaque and people can't send market signals through the power of the, you know, free hand of the market to the vendors that security is a thing they care about. Putting stickers that say this device is never going to receive an update, is incapable of auto-updating, and the vendor doesn't care and is not going to support it, people might actually vote with their wallet and go buy the one that has, you know, 1.5 out of 5 cyberstars instead of 0 cyberstars, like everything else on the shelf. So, yeah, no, I think it's a good idea. The mechanics of doing it in a way that's useful, you know, obviously there's some details there and there's lots of arguments you can have about how effective and what sort of testing and blah, blah, blah. But even something as simple as, how long will the manufacturer support this for? Like, its end of life date is 3 years.
Does it automatically update? Does it use encryption? Does it, you know, yeah. I mean, it's just you can get a long way with IoT by ticking off some of those basics, I think. So this is a good idea.
Yeah, but even just end of support life. Like, even if it was only that, we would be in a way better position.
You need a best before date.
We do, right? Yeah, use by. If every rubbish, you know, $60 Android phone at a telco store had a best before 2012 AD on it, then we would see a change in the Android ecosystem, and that would be better for everybody. So,
yeah. Now, Adam, before we go, we're nearly, that's almost it for the week's news, but we have to discuss a story that is, you know, that I've been dreading talking about. Morgan Marquis-Bois, who's someone you and I both know. Well, hello there. You may have noticed that I've just faded out of the news segment there. That's because Adam and I were speaking about the credible accusations of sexual assault levied against Morgan Marquis-Bois. Until recently, he was the Director of Information Security at First Look Media, the publisher of The Intercept, and is well known for his work with Citizen Lab and various other groups. He's also a Kiwi, and Adam's known him for about 20 years. That conversation basically broke Adam's brain. So I've prepared this statement instead, because I don't think it's right to do this week's show without addressing the Morgan issue. Now, don't get me wrong, Adam is appalled and has no trouble acknowledging that something awful has happened here. It's just that trying to talk about this in a coherent way is quite difficult for him. He did talk about it. It's my decision to edit that out, and it's my decision alone. I've also known Morgan, but not well, for about 11 years. I'm friends with a bunch of the Kiwi security people like Adam and Pipes, but I can't say Morgan was ever a real, you know, friend of mine, not in the same way. But he was a real friend of actual real friends of mine, and what he's alleged to have done is disgusting. First and foremost, what he's done to the women involved is disgusting, but beyond that, it's what he's done to everyone who's ever considered him a friend. I'm yet to speak with a friend of his who isn't appalled and actually quite upset. The grapevine in circles he moves in has moved at record pace and he has gone to ground. He actually disappeared a couple of months ago, as best I can tell. He posted something to Facebook in July about going into recovery because he's, quote, hurt people. Now, if that's a preemptive attempt to hide his behaviour behind addiction issues, I've just got to go ahead and say it. That's completely piss weak. Hiding behind recovery would be an epic d*** move. Now, look, to be honest, I always thought Morgan was kind of a jerk, but I never had any reason to suspect that he was someone who had committed, you know, sexual assault against women in two countries over a decade, which is the word on the grapevine. Now, there have been no first-hand accounts of wrongdoing actually published on the internet, but given the fact that basically every organisation he was ever associated with has walked away from him and he hasn't said a peep, we're going to have to go ahead and assume that he has behaved in a horrid, predatory way under all of our noses for a period of something like 10 years. And we need to do better. I'm really sick of hearing stories from women about being groped or assaulted at industry events by dude bros. And when I say industry events, I absolutely 100% include hacker events in that. And I'm sick of hearing men say women are complaining about nothing. We have a real problem here. When I joined this industry, it was virtually an all-male affair. I mean, it was a near-total testosterone festival, and that has changed a lot, which is a fantastic thing. If anything, you know, one thing I feel guilty about at the moment is I don't have enough women on this show because I'm still using a contact book of people, you know, that I've collected over the last 17 years or so, and it's lots of dudes, and I know I need to do better in that regard. And I think, you know, that's what it takes. I think it takes all the men in this industry to start thinking along those lines. Now, I'm not in any way sort of trying to downplay or dismiss or minimize the hard work that so many women in this industry have done in this area. What I'm saying is fixing this shouldn't just be up to them. It's up to all of us. You know, we've got to ask ourselves, what can I do to make this a better industry for women? What can I do to make women feel safe at industry events? Because I can tell you with absolute certainty, they don't feel safe, and that is unacceptable. Now, you know, again, I'm not saying it's okay, ladies, we've got this. I'm not saying men can fix this without the guidance of the wonderful women in this industry. There's going to have to be some real dialogue here. But let's get serious about this. Now, you might be wondering why I'm talking about sexism and sort of, you know, lower level offending and that sort of stuff in the context of speaking about accusations of serious sexual assault. Well, here's why I'm talking about that. 10 years. You know, apparently this was going on for 10 years and no one felt confident or safe enough to speak up. And you've got to ask yourself why that is. We need to do better. And as for you, Morgan, f*** you and the horse you rode in on too. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Daniel Gruss, a postdoctorate researcher at the Graz University of Technology in Austria. He was one of the authors of a paper titled Another Flip in the Wall of Rohammer Defences. That paper had a lot of authors, so I won't name them all now, but I have linked through to it in this week's show notes. Basically, the paper outlines a clever way of doing new Rohammer attacks by burying them in a so-called SGX enclave. Now, I didn't really know much about SGX before this interview, and I'm guessing a few listeners are in the same boat, so don't worry, you will hear me ask him about, like, what the hell is an SGX enclave in this interview. But the upshot is these researchers figured out a way to crash cloud services remotely by doing, you know, performing a bit flip that just causes them to lock up. But they were also able to get reliable privilege escalation on personal computers using this technique, which is, yeah, bad news for reasons that you'll discover in this interview. Here is Daniel explaining how the paper came about.
So the basic idea that we had was we want to see whether we can build a better Rohammer defense. And while we were searching for a Rohammer defense, we came across a very interesting effect that when we were hammering only one memory location within SGX, we observed that sometimes the entire machine would just halt. And this was very curious, and I was assuming that the student that we were working with was doing something wrong. And at the same time, our colleagues from Australia, Yuvalia Rom and his student Sioli, made the same observation outside of SGX, that when they hammered only one memory location instead of two, as in every previous Rohammer attack, when hammering only one memory location, they also got bit flips. And then we were also able to confirm that the crashes that we observed were due to bit flips in the SGX integrity checked memory area. So this was a very nice way for us to find to find out that there is a bit flip in the integrity checked memory area, because SGX already provides this feature. And with this observation, this changed a lot, because before we thought, okay, we need to hammer two rows, we need physical proximity, but all of this is now somehow voided, because we can just hammer a single memory location.
Now, I mean, from this observation, I'm going to make a leap here, but from this observation, and this is what your paper talks about, from there to turning this into a reliable exploitation technique, you managed to get there, didn't you?
Yes. So basically, the earlier exploitation techniques usually targeted page tables. Page tables are very powerful if you can attack them, because they map virtual addresses from virtual addresses to physical addresses. And if you are able to change this mapping, then you're accessing different physical memory that you're not allowed to access. And the page tables, of course, they need to be stored somewhere as well. So they are stored in memory as well. So you have some translation map in memory. And if you could modify it, then you could access any physical memory location. You would be virtually the kernel if you can do that. And the previous attacks flipped a bit in there so that they changed the address from a valid address that they are allowed to access to one of their own page tables, because they filled the entire memory with page tables. So then they have access to one of their own page tables, which is equivalent to having root privileges, because they can change everything in physical memory. There has been a defense that proposed to not place kernel pages, and page tables are counted as kernel pages, not placing kernel pages anywhere in proximity to user pages. And if you implement this countermeasure, you cannot hammer anymore in a way that you flip a bit in a page table. So we need to overcome this countermeasure as well. And there we found also a new, had also a new idea. We thought, why don't we just flip bits in user space binaries like sudo? And this is, if we could do this, this would be very direct and very easy to understand. So we flip a bit in sudo. For instance, there is a jump zero. If the password check that jumps somewhere, if the password check was okay, so if you entered the right password. And we thought, okay, if we flip one bit there, we can flip the jump zero to a jump not zero. So we exactly inverting the control flow. And then if we enter a wrong password, we will be root. Now, this technique is a bit difficult to implement, because the sudo binary or any page of a binary that you have in your system exists in memory only a single time. And where it is in physical memory, you probably cannot induce a bit flip in exactly this location. So there we needed another technique to help us to place the binary in exactly the right position where we can induce the right bit flip. And there we came. So we could have used some spraying or grooming techniques that already existed. So spraying is you just fill the entire memory with the same data structure. That doesn't work in this case, because we cannot arbitrarily clone the binary. It's not possible to load the binary page multiple times into memory, because the page cache of the operating system prevents that. The page cache will ensure that the binary page only exists a single time in physical memory. But with grooming, we could have done something. So we could have filled the entire memory and then allocate in the right moment the right binary page. But grooming is ad hoc very unstable, because this is in the page cache and it will only be evicted if you fill the entire memory. And filling the entire memory brings you very, very close to getting out of memory. And getting out of memory crashes the system. So we came up with a novel technique for that as well, which we call memory waylaying. And there we use a side channel to check whether we are already at the right physical location. And if we are not, we allocate pages that we map as executable. So they don't have to be executable binaries, but we just take some file and map it as executable. And by accessing these pages, these now executable pages, we can evict the page cache without filling the entire memory. And this yields a very reliable technique to place the binary page at the location where we want it to be. in the end, then we have our modified pseudo binary, which we just start one time and then we root.
Now, that's nice. Like, everyone likes root. Everyone listening to this podcast, they like root. So walk me through the significance of SGX here. You might want to start off by explaining actually what SGX is.
Yes, SGX is a instruction set extension by Intel, and this instruction set extension aims at providing a secure execution environment in untrusted environments. So, for instance, you want to run your super secret and advanced algorithm in the cloud to compute something, I don't know, machine learning, but you don't trust the cloud provider and you fear the cloud provider might steal your ideas and steal your algorithm. Then you just put it in an enclave and you encrypt it and you let it you need to get a signature from Intel or from a BIOS vendor. This part is not yet ready, so there is no, in practice, there is no way to get a valid signature for normal users yet, but there will be in the future. When you have your enclave and it's encrypted, the enclave can somehow check whether the system is in a regular state or whether it has been manipulated. So whether all the security guarantees that SGX provides actually hold. And if this check is okay, then in a remote attestation procedure, the enclave can confirm that everything is fine, and then it will decrypt the critical content. And then you're guaranteed that the cloud provider cannot read what you're executing on their system.
So just going back for a second, though, you said that to run code, to run SGX code, you need a signature from Intel. Does that mean that, you know, your exploitation technique here has to be signed by Intel?
So currently it's not really clear because there is no mechanism like this yet. And many papers in this area propose that you just run unsigned enclaves because they still have these nice security properties that they protect your code.
Okay, now also, I'm with you. So I get it that you were going to do, so that there is a model for trusted signing of this stuff, but you don't need one to actually be able to use the SGX extensions and to use your exploitation technique. Have I got it right?
Yes.
Excellent.
Especially if you require a user to say, if you want to play our game, you have to run our DRM enclave, even if it's not signed, then you don't know what's going on inside the enclave. It could be a Rowhammer attack.
Okay, so what does a payload look like using this exploitation technique? Is that it? Is it you're going to execute some binary on a user system and they're going to need to allow this thing to run? Is that what it looks like?
Yes, they just run a binary and then they can't see anything anymore because anything running inside SGX is entirely shielded from the rest of the system. They just see that the enclave uses some of the CPU. So Intel was aware of some of these problems here. So they restricted what SGX enclaves can do. For instance, they cannot execute any syscalls. They cannot perform some instructions that Intel considered to be maybe insecure. And so they restricted.
So they're crippled a bit, but at the same time, you can still use it to do bit flips and win, right?
Yeah, the problem is that Rowhammer actually does not require to do anything but accessing your own memory locations.
One thing that was pointed out as a way to maybe detect this previously used to be, you know, code that is designed to perform these types of actions in memory is kind of trivial to detect. But that's only when you run it in a sandbox, right? So if you're running it in this SGX environment, you're just not going to see it. I mean, you can't sandbox this, can you, and see what it does?
So you first wouldn't get the unencrypted code. You only get the encrypted code, and the code will only decrypt itself if it passed the remote attestation and obtained the key from the remote server. So it won't decrypt unless you're actually running it in a proper SGX environment.
So is there any way to run some sort of SGX emulator just to examine like code behavior?
The SGX emulator wouldn't pass the remote attestation. because there are keys integrated inside the CPU, and the remote attestation uses these keys, and you can't do these signing operations without actually running in a real Intel CPU with real SGX.
You had a lot of co-authors on this paper, but what's been the reaction to people who work more on the commercial side of information security and vulnerability research when they've seen what you've done here? What's their take been?
Usually, I would assume that vendors do not really think that this is a relevant issue. And there are several reasons to that. First, the denial of service attack that we explain that would work in the cloud. It would work if you either do not use ECC memory or if you do not double the refresh rate. But if you do both, it's really, really unlikely that the attack will succeed. And the large cloud providers, they will do both. The smaller ones, we don't know. So we have performed another study that is not yet published, where we looked at memory usage of cloud providers. And we have strong indications that they try to save money with respect to memory wherever they can. And it would not be surprising if they also use non-ECC memory, because that saves you like 30 to 40% of money and also not doubling the refresh rate.
How does doubling the refresh rate help here?
So the underlying problem, the physical problem, is that you charge the DRAM cells, and if you charge them, they store their value. So for instance, a 1 if they are charged and a 0 if they are not charged. Over time, the charge will go through parasitic effects over to other cells, to neighboring cells. It will also go through the bit line. So you will lose the charge over time, and that works very quickly. So the DRAM specification says that every cell needs to be refreshed once in a 64 millisecond interval. If you don't do that, they are not keeping their content anymore. And if you double the refresh rate, then you're going down from 64 milliseconds to 32 milliseconds. So you're effectively refreshing every cell double as often. That, of course, reduces also the time that the cell loses its charge to half the time. So the Rowhammer effect. So if you're accessing proximate rows, so you let's think of the traditional way to attack it. You are looking at three rows in one DRAM bank, and you are hammering the outer ones. And by accessing the outer DRAM rows, you drain some charge from the adjacent cell in the middle. And by doing that often enough, you drain enough charge from this cell that it will flip the value from 1 to 0. For
instance. So really what you're saying is you want it refreshed more often so it doesn't have a chance to deplete the charge.
Yes.
And is that really going to be our best defense against this as a class of attacks, is just for everybody out there to somehow find a way to double their DRAM refresh time?
So in the 2014 ISTA paper by Kim et al., they already investigated whether this would help, and they figured that that works for many DRAM modules, but not for all. For some of them, they would even have had to increase it by a factor of 8, the refresh rate, and then it induces a significant performance and power consumption overhead. If you increase the refresh rate by that factor. So it's not really practical in all cases.
So the question becomes, what are the practical defenses against, Rowhammer as privilege escalation, especially when you've combined it with, the fabulous cloak of invisibility that is SGX?
So I think already that GCAT already made a very important step towards a defense. I also think that memory allocator based defenses could help, but the problem now is that we didn't fully understand how Rowhammer bit flips can be triggered. And it's always a problem if you're trying to defend against something that you do not fully understand. So that was also why we then switched. So we wanted to write a defense paper, but we came up with another attack paper because we couldn't come up with a clever defense. So what we think would be the right approach is to investigate further what effects are really possible. What can we actually do to still have a Rowhammer bit flip? What exploit targets can we choose? For instance, apparently the assumption was wrong that we need to hammer kernel pages. We can also hammer user space pages like the pseudo binary. So this assumption was also wrong. And if we're combining all of that, we have too many assumptions that were just wrong. And we first need to understand the Rowhammer bug more properly, more deeply, so that we can come up with defenses.
So you're not at the point where you can say, oh, we all just need to do this. Just at the start of your answer there, you mentioned that an organization, was it GCAT, had made some steps in the right direction. What were they?
It's a paper that was at Usenix earlier this year by Brasser et al. And they suggested to split the user space pages and the kernel space pages physically in memory. So they put the kernel at the upper end and the user space at the lower end. In the middle, they leave a large gap so that you cannot induce any bit flips because you're physically not in any proximity.
But your paper deals with flipping bits in user space, so that doesn't really help, does it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So now the question comes up, how do we solve that? Because we cannot isolate every user space binary in memory, because we have way too many of them. If I look on my process, I have something like 150 processes running. If we, for every process, need to leave a gap of 2 megabytes or something, I would waste already at least 300 megabytes of memory just to isolate the processes.
Might be the cost of doing business in times to come. Daniel Gross, thank you very much for joining us on the show to walk us through the research that you keyed up on Rowhammer. It's been very interesting.
Thank you.
That was Daniel Gross there of the University of Technology Graz in Austria. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Dan Guido of Trail of Bits. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Trail of Bits is probably best described as a security engineering firm. They won't audit your code and give you a report that you forget about or just, you know, put in a desk drawer somewhere. They'll find the problems and they'll actually fix them for you. They also build and customize tools. I believe they had or still have a contract with Facebook to work on OS Query, that sort of stuff. So when Dan heard Google Project Zero's Natalie Silvanovich and Thinkst Canary's Haroon Mir on a recent episode of this show talking about decent security engineering, Dan was pretty into it. He contacted me and basically said, you know, that's our jam. That's what we do. So he really enjoyed that show. So we thought it would be a good idea to get him on the show in this sponsored segment to talk about what it's like doing those sorts of projects as an outside party. The thinking being, if Dan can sell these project ideas to clients, Risky Business listeners might be able to sell them internally. Anyway, here's what Dan had to say.
You know, there's many cases where we sit down with a client that's just hired us to create some custom software for them, and they're not quite sure of exactly what they want built. And the toughest challenge for us is we actually reserve an entire 8 straight hours on the first day that we work with any client just to have a talk with them and to let them talk to us. We're not there to advertise our capabilities. We're not there to force solutions down their throat. We actually just want to hear from them. So we call these project inceptions, which is language that we take from the kind of agile development world. And, you know, we may actually know what we want to give to the client, but it's more important for them to actually say it. To have them come to that conclusion so that they understand that that's what they need and buy into the whole process. So that's kind of a training exercise that I've had many people on the team rotate through, where we have different people that sit in on new project inceptions or re-inceptions or, you know, iteration planning meetings and that kind of thing. And it's not a skill set that is widely appreciated or even widely discussed in the security community. Everybody, you know, talks about these 2-week segments of the year where they get some time to do research and then create a new black hat talk. But the opportunity is to build skills to actually communicate with clients and, you know, understand what can help them are harder to find.
I can imagine, too, that that would have been a bumpy road initially when you're trying to introduce that as a concept to the market, right? You're sitting down with these presumably sort of technology executives at major corporations. They've got some problems. You've maybe got some solutions. But getting that communication right, I'd imagine there would be a few tricks to it. Can you think of what they are?
So the funny thing is that in a lot of other respects, companies are really good at purchasing these kinds of services. They understand exactly what they need to do and how they should have these conversations, but not in the security hierarchy. So there's definitely kind of a lack of expertise on the client side as well of what kind of situation they're walking into.
That's kind of what I was getting at with the bumpy road, right? Because you've got to sort of bring people to that conclusion and I guess convince them of or help them to realize what's possible. Is that a big part of it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The trick is really just have gone through it. The trick is to, sit there with a whiteboard, to be patient, to ask leading questions, make sure they're open-ended, and structure your conversation around whatever it is that you're discussing, whether it's potential risks that you want to address or if it's potential features that you want built. We have a lot of really good knowledge around how to do threat modeling, and threat modeling is kind of a similar story where you have these needs that flow through the rest of the application until they're finally mitigated and you can track them back. Well, the same thing needs to get done from a development perspective where you can talk about, well, who is the user and what do they want? How do they feel when they use the software? And then create some stories from that and start working your way through of like, okay, here's how we're going to make the user's life better.
Can you give me an example where this approach has worked really well and also where it hasn't? Because I find that interesting.
If you do it right, it always works well. I think the main complaints, what are the complaints we even get? Like, if you're doing this well, then that means you're continuously delivering something that's valuable to your client on a week-by-week basis. And they can see that, every Monday when you show up, you've got some new demo that you can show off that's like, oh, wow, now me as a user or me as the client, I can do something that's better than I could do last week.
Mm.
So
really it's about just getting the ball rolling and then ensuring there's a continuous improvement and that, makes it a live project and then everyone's sort of fully bought in. I mean, I can see that that's something we've just drawn out here that I think a lot of people would find a useful perspective, Dan, because this is a great way to get management on board. Like once you get over that first hump of, giving something the green light, this is a way to keep it, keep it bubbling.
Yeah. And it's a complete opposite from where our government contracts are. We do government consulting as well. And on those, we're working on 4-year long research programs. And with that, you spec out like, well, I can build this giant, I have to spec out 4 years worth of waterfall development. And I know that at the end of it, I'm going to have a thing that does X. But for the commercial clients that we have, we have to flip to the entire opposite approach of how do I deliver value early? And how do I show the client that we can actually solve their problem? Because they can kill that contract at any moment, right? Like if they get upset, like, ah, you're not doing what I want and I don't really see where this is going, then that client's going to leave.
And I guess that's why you're starting to co-opt, DevOps terminology is because, these sorts of projects are going to have to be on a, conducted on a DevOps basis, right?
Exactly. And that's why, when you're asking me, how do these projects go south? One of the things that I might have been concerned with originally is that we're not actually delivering what it is that they need quick enough. But really, as long as the customer can see that continuous improvement week to week, then it's all going to be okay.
I guess too, if someone takes a wrong turn, it's pretty easy to correct at that point, right? Because not like a 4-year waterfall healthcare.gov disaster zone.
It's kind of funny. I haven't been around the industry for that long. I still feel like I'm one of the younger ones, even though I'm starting to edge up on my mid 30s here. But I've spoken to people that were at stake in the early days, and the first clients that they had, they walked in the door and they said, all right, great. You've got all this code. We have the people that can fix it for you. Just get us hands on the keyboard. Give us access to your CVS, your Subversion repository at the time. And we can fix it. They'll find all the bugs. They'll commit all the patches and the software will be secure. And at that stage, that's where it got kind of off track, I think, where the industry left kind of a course that would have helped itself, because the only thing that those clients back in like the late 90s, early 2000s knew how to buy were pen tests. They knew how to buy well, actually, no, all I want is just want you to tell me what to do and then I'll go fix it. And I feel like it's such a wasted opportunity. So I'm actually really happy for the things that Natalie talked about. Like, I think clients are finally coming around to the process of, well, is there somebody that we can bring in to not just advise us about what the risks are and not just fill up a giant bug tracker for us, but also help us deprecate third-party dependencies, also help us build with a modern compiler, also help us check in a custom fuzzer. And
You're right. There was very rarely any sort of strategy, you know, strategic change that resulted from pen tests and code audits. It was like, great, we've ticked the box, ship it. You know, that was always been the attitude, and it's been entrenched for way too long.
Yeah, and it's training at scale, right? That's what you're doing. Is every single one of those reports is the most expensive piece of training you could buy for the developer on your team at that time, but it doesn't actually fix the root cause of, you know, is the architecture that I'm using safe? Do I have all this duplicated code that's all insecure spread out through my code base? Do I have a branching strategy that makes sense? Can I actually track fixes through the code base? So I'm really happy to get hands back on keyboard. But, you know, this leads into approaching providing services that right way requires a different mindset, because you can't just go through and, you know, kick down all the doors. You have to actually integrate with the team that you work on. You have to work the way that they do. You have to communicate with their engineers. You have to get their trust. You have to show them that what you do is actually going to provide value week to week. Because the engagements are open-ended. It's not a set report that you get at the end. It's so you know, measurements can be sometimes a challenge. That's definitely something we talk about very early on in the engagements that we have. We want to know how the work we're doing is going to be valued and how it's going to be measured, and then work towards some of those goals more directly.
You know, I think things are actually changing, right? And one of the things that makes me say that is, you know, Adam and I have been speaking about the Equifax breach a bit, and, you know, he had this great line where he said, you know, most enterprise applications are rubbish Tomcat Java apps, you know, that someone wrote 5 years ago and no one remembers how they work or whatever, right? And you know, that was all a bit of ha-ha, but there's a lot of truth to that. I got a message from a CISO of a company that you have heard of, you know, in the days after that podcast. And the message here, I'll just read it. It says, what Adam said about managing enterprise applications is exactly how it is. It's frustrating as all hell. We have applications where the app teams have no idea how the apps work, nor how the app communicates across the organization. A lot of what I'm doing is starting at the root, integrating all of my testing and tools into the DevOps process and getting buy-in from the development and application teams. This leaves the legacy apps as the problem, but it stops the bleeding moving forward, right? Now that's, you know, that's an admission by a CISO from a major company that this is very hard, right? What he's saying there is, like, we cannot fix some of this legacy stuff, but at least we can stop the bleeding. And by really embracing some of the stuff that you're talking about. So do you feel like there is a real culture shift happening now?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we've even had people approach us to talk about integrating the more researchy things that we do, like the CyberGround challenge work. You talk about you know, vast, wide-ranging amounts of code that you're not quite sure exactly what does what. There's lots of financial institutions out there that have tens of thousands of microservices that may all be written in C or C++. And having the ability to operate at scale to find bugs and to react to new exploits in every single one of them would be enormous. And there's no product out there that's going to let you do that. All the development is custom. The technology is custom. And you have to hire these people that are willing to learn how to navigate that kind of detailed, technical, you know, intricate problem. But that's exactly where we can fit in. But I guess what I'm asking is,
you know, this new batch of CISOs, right? Like CISOs used to be MBAs who were friends with someone on the board, right? And that's how they got the job. These days, it seems like a lot of technical people have moved up. They know what has to be done. But are you feeling that sea change? Because they're the sort of CISOs I wind up in contact with, right? Risky Business, the audience has kind of, you know, we've all grown up together and they used to be pen testers 10 years ago and now they're CISOs. Is that something that you're seeing as well? Or am I sort of a bit biased here because they're the people I'm most likely to be in contact with?
No, you're definitely right. There is a trend there. And there's people that, you know, I'd say I grew up with that are CISOs now, right? There are people that I remember from two jobs ago that have made it up the top of the CISO career track. And the kinds of work that they value and the kinds of ways they measure themselves are fundamentally different than the kind of, you know, Gartner-driven, well, I need a box that ticks every, or I need a literal pizza box that ticks every single one of these boxes in this giant quadrant of products that I can buy to cover my, you know, cover my ass. But yeah, we have a lot of great relationships with people that that do understand that there's value in engineering your own security solutions. And I think the problem for us now is we need more people that can think like that up at the top. That's the biggest challenge for the growth of my own company. And I think it's the biggest challenge for the growth of the industry at large too.
Dan Guido, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Patrick. It's been great.
That was Dan Guido of Trail of Bits there with this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to Dan for that. And huge thanks to Trail of Bits for sponsoring a couple of episodes of this show every year. You can check them out at trailofbits.com. And I've actually linked through to some work they did that's relevant to Rowhammer as well. So you can check that out in this week's show notes. And that is it for this week's news. I'll be back with more next week. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.